The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia, and thank you very much for joining us. I'm Laura Kovacs, and I'm glad to be here. A two-time world champion debater and a former coach of the Harvard College Debating Union and the Australian National Debating Team, Bo So has also won the World Universities Debating Championship. In his new book, Good Arguments, How Debate Teaches Us to Listen and Be Heard, he describes how debate empowered him to find his voice amidst his family's emigration from Korea to Australia when he was only 10, the ways in which many other people have used spoken rhetoric on their paths to success, and the specific debate strategies anyone can use to improve their lives. This evening, he'll be joined in conversation with award-winning journalist and broadcaster, Tracy Matysak. Thank you so much for being here. The screen is all yours.
Well, thank you so much, Laura, and welcome everyone. We're delighted that you're able to join us here at the Free Library for what we hope will be an enlightening conversation. As Laura said, we have budgeted time for your questions toward the end of our program. So do just go down into that Q&A box there. You can click on that icon and add your question there, and we'll get through as many of them as we can before we have to say good night. But all of that said, Bo, welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Thank you so much, Tracy. And thank you so much to the team at the library for having me. If I can say, Tracy, just before we start, when I was in middle school, I did a school report on Independence Hall. And this was me as a middle schooler in Australia. And I don't remember much of what I wrote at the time. But I do remember when I came here for college and I visited Philadelphia for the first time, I remember being struck by what an amazing thing it was that the birthplace of this country was remembered not as the seat of a monarch or even a shrine to a deity or a battlefield, but rather a chamber for debate and disagreement. And it's hard to think of a place that is more of a testament to the thesis of the book, which is that disagreement can be more than a source of division and pain. And it's hard to forget that, or it's easy to forget that, but there's a reminder in Philadelphia. So it's a particular honor for me to be joining you and to be speaking at the library tonight.
Well, thank you so much for saying that. And I think along those lines, that's exactly where I'd like to start, Bo, which is that you said that your chief aim in writing the book was to explain how debate can teach us to disagree well. What do you mean by disagreeing well?
There's no one answer to the question, I don't think, Tracy, because disagreements, as with any encounter in its fullness might, helps us do a lot of different things. It helps us see each other more clearly. It helps us test out ideas. It helps us compare our viewpoints of the world so that we might be able to puzzle together a fuller picture of things. And I want to make room for all of those different purposes that disagreement can serve, that debate can help us achieve. In writing this book, I was thinking about which of those I might prioritize, which of those might matter to me, but I decided to settle on a more modest goal, which is to disagree in such a way that both sides can agree it was worthwhile, right? Not that it was all the only conversation we would ever need or that it alone was enough to change our trajectory for the better, but that it was good enough to keep the conversation going.
I think that's critically important because we tend to think about disagreement as a negative thing. And for those of us who tend to be conflict avoidant, and I'm asking for a friend here.
You're asking for me.
I think that's an important way to think about it. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that for those of us who have been conflict avoidant. And you write in the book that you also had made the choice to avoid conflict and that you felt that silence was safer, but somewhere along the way, you changed your mind. Talk about that if you would.
Of course. So I wrote this book because I moved from South Korea, where I was born, to Australia in elementary school without speaking a word of English. And I very quickly learned the hardest part of doing that was adjusting to real life conversation, but to disagreements in particular, where passions tend to run and people tend to interrupt and you get spun out of conversation. And I felt in those moments that disagreements were simply not worth the trouble, you know? And so this urge to run away from conflict is, I don't think it's people are born a certain way where, you know, they are conflict averse or something like that. I think it's an instinct that we all have that comes to the fore at different points in our lives. And for me, I kind of resolved that was how I was going to live my life until I joined in the fifth grade the debate team, because I was promised that in debate, when one person speaks, no one else does. And I found there's something that's richer than mere agreement, you know? And I think, Tracy, just on your question about what role disagreement should play, I think there is an enormous amount of richness to be found in sameness too, right? In commonality, in sympathy, in fellow feeling, in empathy. But that's only really one side of the equation, isn't it? And in the same way you might, in the same way you might want bittersweet experiences, right? Because it completes things, and both sides of that contributes a flavor that the other cannot. I think the same is true of disagreement. So disagreement is not, for me, simply something we choose to engage in or not. It's a fact about our existence that we are different from other people and that we must find ways to coexist. And the choice to disagree or not is, for me, in many instances, a choice to engage with that reality or to run away from it.
Mm. But what do you say to the person who agrees with what you're saying, but has difficulty finding the courage to express disagreement for whatever reason? How do you overcome that fear of expressing disagreement? I guess because you're thinking that there's some risk associated with it.
Yeah. And it's a jump that I think each of us have to make first in our childhoods, isn't it? Right? To say we have a voice. And are we going to raise it or not, right? And it's a choice that we have to continue to make as we progress in our adult lives. How do we empower people to do that? Number one, I think it's not on the individual alone, right? It's about the kind of climate of public conversation that we as a society create. Mm-hmm. And so, And I feel this most pressingly for children, but the more I grow up and the less time I spend being a child, the more I see it's important for all of us. So there is a communal responsibility. And I think the second thing that I'm trying to do with this book is one thing that helped me a lot is the sense that some people are natural born arguers, and I wasn't one of those. And for me and for people like me, I think the knowledge that there is a skill to argumentation, that there are certain dynamics that people have studied and people have practiced and people have found ways to pass down through the generations, I think that can be really empowering. So I don't want it to just be a story of individual empowerment and self-equipment and preparation, though I think that plays some role. I want us to also think about the kind of conversation we want to create as a society that makes room for more voices. And as you say, Tracy, it gives people the courage to participate.
So you used the phrase, the climate of conversation, and you talked about societal conversation. And you and I were talking before we began this webinar about just the polarization, the division that we're seeing in our country, the arguing that we are doing as a nation. And I'm wondering for you, as you've watched all this play out, how did we get here? What do you think are the main contributors to the kind of division that we're experiencing right now in this country?
It's a really rich question. And not every aspect of the answer would I be the expert to speak on, right? So there are structural reasons for the kinds of polarization that we're seeing, whether that be the deepening wealth gap or the great sort of where people live and you know, policies such as housing policies that have divided people over many generations. It's not that I want to underplay the importance of those structural elements. It's that the part that I feel more equipped to speak about and perhaps to do something about is when you have all of those structural factors and institutional factors in play, the quality of our conversation suffers, right? And I want to suggest that bad disagreements can become self-fulfilling and self-reinforcing, right? Mm-hmm. When we engage in disagreements with family members who disagree with us or try to reach across the political aisle or to speak with a colleague whose fundamental beliefs differ from our own, and that conversation goes badly, our faith in the power of disagreement diminishes, right? And for me, Tracy, that owes in part to a loss of shared value, loss of shared truths, all of these institutional factors, but also a loss in a shared set of skills of how we disagree better, which was once seen as a kind of a requirement of citizenship and a commonwealth, you know, in the truest sense, as a kind of a common possession that we inherited as people who were born into and became stewards of democracies narrowly, liberal societies, and more broadly of nations. So I think there are, again, not one, there's no one answer to the question, but the part that relates most directly to the project that I'm trying to advance as I see it is a loss of faith and confidence in what disagreements can do, owing to an atrophying or a loss of a common set of skills for disagreeing well.
Do you think that those skills are something that we need to be thinking about teaching our children, starting in school, teaching them rhetoric, teaching them those kinds of skills that help us to disagree well?
I really do. And I think one of the really wonderful things about debate is it really can't be that hard because kids do it. And no amount of, you know, reading precocity into our nephews and nieces can overcome the fact that they're children. And so, you know, it's not the only education children need for sure, right? And there has to be a broader base of moral education, civic education that accompanies this, because we know, and we might get to it later in the conversation, that debate has darker shades too. So merely teaching children about it is insufficient, but my hope is, and my view is, that a citizenry that has been taught from a young age to discern good arguments from bad, to say something as basic as, what's the evidence for that? That such a citizenry has a degree of immunity from the kind of abuses of public rhetoric, the kind of hijacking of public conversation that I think has become endemic in our political culture.
And debate, of course, requires not only persuasive speaking skills and critical thinking skills, but it also requires careful listening. Can you talk about the importance of listening and how we can all maybe sharpen our skills in that area?
It's a very strange feature of debate. And I don't know whether you remember any of the kids from high school who did it or college who did it, Tracy, is they tend to be slightly marginal figures. and that's not a euphemism, you know, they're kind of, they're oddballs. And more seriously, you know, people like the incoming Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson has spoken about how, for someone from a marginalized background, debate was a kind of a source of empowerment. Mm-hmm. And I think there are lots of reasons for that, but the main one, in my view, is what you just put your finger on, Tracy, which is people who are used to being on the periphery, they know how to listen and they know how to read a room. And they know that sometimes, in order not to get hurt, they have to check a few times about where the conversation is at before they intervene.
Yeah.
And in debate, it's very easy to focus on the person at the front of the room, but the rest of us on the wings preparing to speak are writing down really in great detail what the other person is saying. We're often putting ourselves into their shoes to say, even if they didn't express this idea perfectly, what's the strongest version of this point, right? What are the set of interests and values that are leading them to make this point? And you do that, I mean, I hope partly because it's the right thing to do, but it's also competitively the advantageous thing to do, because you know stronger versions of the argument are coming in the future. The other person won't feel as though they've received a full hearing unless you've not only accounted for what they've said, but maybe something a little bit better than that. And so all that starts with listening. And the subtitle of this book begins somewhat counterintuitively with the idea that debate teaches us to listen and be heard. And I think that's about the right order, that you listen in order to be heard.
Yeah. I was on the speech half of the speech and debate team in high school, so I was one of those oddball kids too, and I totally relate to what you're saying.
This is a reunion.
I've been thinking too, Bo, that so often when we engage in disagreement, you know, our arguments can go sideways because of the emotion. And we see that in the public square all the time, but it happens in our homes and in our workplaces as well. What do you say to people who want to be able to keep their emotions in check, be able to disagree well without allowing emotion to take over and maybe take the argument in a completely different direction?
It's a very difficult question, because sometimes people want hyper-rational discussion, and you want a kind of a spreadsheet of statistics in either side's favor, and there's this kind of insistence on rationality. And I tend to think, not only does it set the barrier to entry to the conversation too high sometimes, but it devoids the resulting conversation of all the things that could hope to make it meaningful. And those are the human elements of emotion, of candor, of bringing yourself to the table sometimes. And so one thing I like about debate is it actually doesn't ask us to set those things aside. Instead, it sees them as things that can be better or worse managed. And I have some ideas about it in the book, but I'll highlight two of them. One is you want to cut arguments down to size. One of the ways in which emotions become overwhelming is when we think an argument is about everything, including who we are, you know, and one of the things debaters know to do is to say, just the way that the speech kids might have, the topic of this debate is this. We're just discussing this for this moment. And we can have other discussions in the future. But in order for us to make some progress, we have to be able to say some things are irrelevant for the purpose of having this discussion. And that doesn't mean you can't bring emotions into it, your personal experiences into it, but we're going to set the topic and agree to that before we start disagreeing. I think the second thing that I'd just quickly add is some of that. One thing I really, you know, admire about the debate community is, and this is something that I think kids understand better than many adults do, which is that you can be right, but you can be the less persuasive side on the day. Mm-hmm. Right. And when the kids after a debate competition get on the bus and say, I'm pretty sure I was right, but you did well there, you know, or you had a good point there, or I fumbled my response to something. That kind of detachment of being correct and being persuasive, I think that can also be quite helpful. And in order for us to be able to kind of take some of the ego out of it, I suspect we probably have to have many more disagreements than we do currently so that we're able to say, you know, I lost that one, but I probably got the better in this one. And over time, hope that the conversation bends towards the direction of some truth.
Yeah. Which leads me to a question about empathy. You write in the book that many of us think of it as a trait that people have or they don't have, but you see it differently, almost like a muscle that can be developed. And I wonder if you would talk about how we can increase our empathy quotient and where humility fits into all of that.
Of course. So, you know, the origins of this are also rooted in biography for me. When I moved to Australia and, you know, I was an immigrant and I felt kind of at odds with where I was, and I felt this real gap between me and my peers. The advice I used to get is have empathy, right? Which is a very annoying thing to to hear, because how do you do that, right? And empathy was kind of spoken about as this spontaneous psychic connection that kind of happens, you know, and you look into someone's eyes and music plays in the background and something has been achieved, or in the church where I was raised, you know, it was almost spoken as a kind of a virtue that you possessed. And it was not until I started debating that that of course those psychic connections can happen, of course those virtues can and should be cultivated, but for most of us who don't know how to do that yet, debate says there's a series of exercises. In debate, in the last 5 minutes before you present your case, you often turn to a fresh sheet of paper and you brainstorm the best arguments for the other side. Mm-hmm. Or you go back over your own case through the eyes of someone who fervently disagrees and try to find all the holes in your reasoning. And mm-hmm. That experience, as you say, Tracy, for me, humbles you. Mm-hmm. It allows you to kind of think for a minute that maybe you haven't gotten it 100%. And whatever the difference between 100% and then some other high two-digit number, that's the gap where I think empathy might arise, mm-hmm. right? It's probably not empathy in its fullness because you're kind of brainstorming their ideas, but it's a sliver, you know? And at a time when our public conversations, in addition to all else, feel so saturated on both sides in some way, where there's not even a kind of an inch room to give. Yeah. That kind of a gap might be important. Yeah. It might be useful.
Yeah. And all leading back to the idea of disagreeing well, it's all part of that process of disagreeing well. Well, you write about the anatomy of an argument. I just want to talk sort of in practical terms for a couple of minutes here. If you could lay that out for us, because you talk about the two basic burdens and then the four W's. So briefly, how does that work and explain it? So maybe that would be useful for us as we're engaging in these conversations.
Yeah. And even the idea that I'm about to present a bunch of infrastructure. so just a warning. And even that idea that this guy is about to present some infrastructure about argument might sound a bit foreign, because nowadays we think an argument is just what you say in defense of what you think, mm-hmm. right? Or it can be this kind of quite inchoate, sometimes even a repetition of what it is that you're arguing. Whereas I think part of what debate teaches is an argument is a very particular thing. And it begins with the two things that any argument must do, which is to show that its main claim is true and that it's important. So mm-hmm. if I'm arguing that we should buy this particular model of car because it's the most fashionable, you need to show, first of all, that it is in fact the most fashionable, because otherwise it's not going anywhere, that argument. And the other is you have to show the fact that it is the most fashionable means that we should buy it, mm-hmm. right? Why is fashion the basis on which we need to make this decision, as opposed to cost or functionality or whether it fits the parking space or something like that? And so around those two basic burdens, the exercise that I refined for the book is called the four W's, which is every argument needs to answer: what is the argument about? Why is it true? When has it happened before, which is usually an example or an illustration? And why is it important, which is getting at the that second burden of importance. And in the book, I talk about it as so I'm going to do infrastructure. Now I'm about to say a Greek word. so I'm doing it all. But it used to be called prognosmata, which was a series of rhetorical exercises that people did of just kind of, as part of their education, writing out lots of arguments within defined structure like this one. And the idea was, regardless of the substance of the point that you wanted to make, on the substance, we as citizens might disagree, but the form of it, the skill of it, that we're all going to possess. Mm-hmm. And for me, that was important because the form was something you could practice. You know, and that was just one way of explaining what an argument should be.
Yeah. In an actual debate tournament, you write about how the competitors do have time to sort of think through their arguments, write their speeches prior to going out there. Of course, in real life, it doesn't work that way, right? We don't have time to sit and sort of carefully structure our arguments. And so in the heat of the moment, you know, how do we disagree well when we're in the midst of the argument, we haven't really had time to sort of sit through and think about the point we want to make or to prepare in the way that a debater would?
I think there's two things there, Tracy. The first is there is an element of preparation that goes on constantly in the background. Right. And that is familiarizing oneself with the skills of disagreement, for example, so that we may be able to reach for them even when the moment strikes. Mm-hmm. But I think the second thing I would say is, many more arguments feel urgent than they actually are. And part of the work that all these acronyms and considerations is doing is to slow things down a little bit, right? So for example, when we're in the midst of a disagreement, to pause and say, wait, what are we actually disagreeing about? That act of naming can make sure we're not talking across one another, or we're fighting about nothing, which sometimes happens, right? It's a misunderstanding, or it's a perceived slight, or something like that. And similarly, with even the four W's and a couple more of those kinds of bits, I tried to polish them as much as possible, you know, so that they could be within reach to check, even as you're making the argument, have I met all the basic requirements? You know, have I gone through these considerations? And it's something you said before, Tracy. I think it's a kind of a muscle, and a set of instincts. And in some ways, the experience of writing the book for me has been reverse engineering from a series of instincts that I had been taught, something that I could teach others for the first time.
I want to talk about just some of the current events that we're seeing. And let me preface it by asking you about this, because certainly it's no secret that we live in a world with lots of disinformation, alternative facts, if you will. And I'm wondering how you think that debate can help us when our arguments oftentimes cannot even meet that burden of truth, let alone of importance.
It's a very, very, very difficult question. And one thing I'm pretty sure about and another thing I'm less sure about. The bit I'm pretty sure about is the proliferation of misinformation and disinformation in part stems from an ethic of like-minded folks egging one another on without challenge from the other side. Right. And so when you have siloed information sources, when you have echo chambers based around commonality, yeah, right, often around the existence of a common enemy, but around commonality and agreement, I think mistruths tend to proliferate. Right. And so whether that means we need to debate at an earlier level, as we spoke about in the education system, whether it means we have to continue the difficult work of challenging one another, I think it speaks at the broadest level to the importance of this, of debate and disagreement. Having said that, it's very difficult, given that is the world in which we're living, to challenge people when the idea of a shared truth is starting to erode. And for me, in debates with, you know, debate has some mechanisms to unearth lies, right? The great advantage of the truth over a lie is things tend to add up, you know, and when you fit it in to other things that we know to be true about the world, you can often see the lie giving way. And in the book, there are some tactics that debaters have developed over time to deal with liars. But the reason why I think this is an incomplete answer to the question, and probably a reason why debate can be one tool to respond to misinformation and disinformation, but needs to be one tool in a broader arsenal, is because I think we're living now in a time, Tracy, and I wonder if you see it as a journalist, where lies are becoming, they're not individual lies so much as they're formative of an entire worldview. And where that's the case, the kind of the contact between truth and lie on which debate relies, the force of that tends to erode. So it's something I worry about a lot. And I don't think we're at a time where, you know, everybody lives in completely different universes or something like that, but it can often feel like we're heading in that direction.
Yeah.
And so that's certainly a part of the urgency that I feel in making the case for disagreement and persuasion and conversation at this time.
I want to ask you about one of the, certainly the biggest debates that we're having as a nation, and that is around gun safety. What are your thoughts, Bo, as you watch that debate play out? And I'm wondering why you think it is that those who favor stricter gun laws, for example, have such a difficult time gaining traction. Is it something that about the way that they are presenting their case? How do you see it?
So I think the first thing is, and the vantage point that I bring to it actually is the perspective of an Australian, which is a country that had a relatively strong gun culture, perhaps not as entrenched as exists in this country. And after a kind of a massacre, gave them up. You know, the government effectively outlawed them. I think the first thing specifically on this issue, on which I'm not an expert, is that I saw back home is a kind of a political leadership and a kind of a leadership from people whose best political interests weren't served by taking strong action, taking action. So I think that that's something kind of specific about the issue that comes to mind. But more broadly, in terms of the conversation around it and that difficulty of getting traction, I think part of it has to do with the channels of communication about these things. And one thing I observe a lot is dueling cable television networks, putting forward their own narratives. On social media, there being disagreements across differences, but in fact, it being quite different to the person you're actually disagreeing with, and it being a sort of a performance for people who are watching at the wings, often on your side. Yeah. And so in that instance, I wonder, again, not being an expert on this particular issue, I wonder whether the site of persuasion is away from some of those more centralized channels of communication, whether it be traditional or social media, and be more about the kinds of conversations people have day to day. Because this, again, is a point about political leadership, but it's also about the conversations that we have. We know that on at least some measures, there is popular support, right? And there is more convergence than we might give credit for. So I'd think about those two things.
Yeah. Well, I have many other questions for you, but in the interests of time, let me go to some questions from our audience. Here's one from Stacy and Anthony, and they ask, how do you attempt to have a constructive and, quote, good argument with someone who argues irrationally or refuses to listen to what you are saying or to even consider your points? Is it possible?
In some instances, it may not. Mm-hmm. So if the other person won't listen to what you're saying at all, it seems unlikely that disagreement is the right way to engage with that person. And so my argument is not that debate is the only mode of disagreeing or that disagreeing is the only mode of engagement that we should have with other people, but rather that it's an important one. And this is a kind of a personal judgment, that fewer people are beyond the pale than we imagine. So in theory, I think there are instances where disagreement and debate are not the appropriate response to someone, right? And, but I probably think the number of people for whom that is true is fewer than we may be tempted to think, especially when we are a little bit more attentive to the channel in which we're having the disagreement. And when we're in the middle of the conversation to say, wait, is it a disagreement that we're trying to have? Is it a debate we're trying to have, or just a brawl? You know, so bringing people back to the kind of conversation we want to have.
Yeah. Alexandra asks, do debaters have a code of ethics, either while in official debates or in general? That is, would using false data or facts be discouraged?
That's a really wonderful question. And it reminds me that debate, in addition to being a series of rules or a wisdom that's accumulated over time, is also a community, mm-hmm. right? And it's a community that's built around and not despite disagreements. And so there's no code of ethics that you sign or anything like that, but the basic requirement is you have to disagree in such a way that others would be willing to face off against you the next week. Right. And that the audience is going to give you a fair hearing when you do appear the following week. And so, and in that way, it reminds me a little bit, I think there's a comparison with what are the codes of ethics of being a citizen in a democracy, right? We compete fiercely for our political views. We compete fiercely on behalf of the parties that we support. But it is in all of our interests to compete in such a way that the game continues. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that the debate community manages less through a kind of a formal code of conduct than a series of values that it instills in younger debaters, but also maintains and reaffirms. Mm-hmm.
Question from Susan, who says, can you say more about this notion of shared skills? What do you mean about skills? Education, political history, specifically what kinds of skills?
That's a terrific question. The skills that I focus on here are the kind of the formal skills of good argument. So that is putting together an argument, knowing what it is, responding to it, using words and gesture to make your point as effectively as you can, and how you decide which arguments to take on and which to ignore, right? And so those are more kind of skill-based rather than, I think what the questioner was getting at with political history, that being kind of more knowledge, right? I think that can depend on the circumstances, and a full civic education must make room for that kind of substantive teaching. But for me, what I'm focused on is the skills component of being able to make arguments, respond, and to deliver it in as effective a way as possible.
Marietta has a similar question as kind of a follow-up. She says, since competition is a process inherent in debate, how might middle and high school courses include personal growth like you're speaking of?
It's a terrific question. I think the first is there are ways to organize debates, right? And there could be debates on literary texts, as it could be debates on historical events and people's perspectives on them. But there are ways to adapt the debate format into something short of a full debate, right? Having people present arguments in favor of a certain proposition and having someone respond or to ask questions of that person, that could be a kind of a more dynamic model of doing it. And there are folks out there thinking a lot about integrating debate into pedagogical approaches. And there are a lot of educators working on that. And so those people would be worth seeking out.
So question from Paul, who says, is there any way to restructure social media so that it's more a forum for debate than simple disagreement?
It's a really rich question. And one of the things that I think debate accustoms you to is being very sensitive to the acoustics of the room in which you speak. And in a lot of ways, the acoustics of social media are not amenable to the kinds of good disagreement that I'm talking about. And in the book, I kind of identify at least three problems. One being that if one of the most foundational principles of debate is everybody is entitled to an equal hearing and a full consideration of their views, on social media, it's not only often about clout, but the most divisive messages that get prioritized, yeah. Right? There was a problem I mentioned before of it being a kind of a performance for an audience of like-minded folks. There's other problems like just anonymous bots, right? Distorting people's adjudication of conversations. And so, you know, a debater's view is obviously not the only one that we need. It may not even be the main one that we need in thinking about what reforms are necessary to social media. But I think that sensitivity to the acoustics of a room and that not every room is created the same, I think that's an important reminder that debate can provide.
Susan asks, doesn't this age of media saturation deter us from critical listening? And maybe there's a question in there, yeah, about how we can sort of filter the constant flow of information that we're getting all the time and all the voices we're hearing.
It's such an important question. And Tracy, you would be much more expert on the media element of it than I would be. I was a junior newspaper reporter. But one of the things that I saw was I went into journalism because I wanted to be in service of the public conversation. And a lot of the people I admire most saw their work as providing people the resources, the information they need, not only to make decisions in their day-to-day lives, but to engage in self-governance. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I see now with media is, especially with the kind of the debate programs and a lot of the punditry, is kind of like prize fighting or something like that. It's like we've abdicated our responsibility to have our own conversations to pundits. So we just kind of watch them kind of as avatars or something like that. And they're
proxies.
proxies, some kind of division of labor, you know? And it's not often avatars for our better angels, right? And so I think on the question about media specifically, I wonder if a part of it is returning to a view of media as serving us and serving our conversations, our project of self-governance, rather than being, as you say, a proxy or a substitute for it.
Question from Garby, who says, do you have additional suggestions or exercises for siphoning emotion from an argument so as not to sabotage oneself?
That's a really terrific question. I think flagged the bit where I was introducing some infrastructure that takes out some of the heat of it, right? When you're having to organize your thoughts, but I'd bring in a new something we haven't talked about, which is we have to make lots of decisions even within the space of one conversation of which disagreements to engage in or not. Right? We don't want a disagreement about who's doing the laundry to also be about what your mother-in-law or father-in-law did the other day, or how you're looking at me, or, you know, what the kids are up to, or something like that. And so in order for us to stop doing that, I encourage us to name the disagreement, but also to consult what I present as a RISA checklist, is checking whether an argument or a disagreement is real, whether it's important enough, whether it's specific enough, and whether the two sides are aligned to prevent us from jumping into a disagreement out of pride or defensiveness or something that's not setting ourselves up. So there is, I'm sure, some kind of Zen-like practice mid-agreement that we need to seek out. And I think maybe remembering that the skill of argument is a part of that. But another very important thing that I try and make clear in the book is it's about setting ourselves up for success in some ways and setting the conversation up for success before we launch into it in the first instance.
Yeah. A couple of additional questions, Beau, before we have to say goodnight. And one of them is that in the book, you talk about how when we argue, so often we assume somebody has to win and somebody has to lose. But you take a very different view of that. And you say that is not necessarily the end game at all.
I think that's right. And, you know, at the World Championships, there are 500 teams that compete. And it becomes knockout at some point. And so 499 teams lose. And almost all your life as a debater, you're in the 499. And I've been in the one twice, right? In 15 or 16 years of being involved in the activity. And even after those two incidents, the morning after you get into a disagreement with your roommate who's never debated in his life, and he wins because he's right. And so the experience of debating is for me in some ways inextricable from the experience of losing. And there's a humility that comes with that. There's a realization that the world doesn't end, that when you lose an argument, that you may even have been right, but that you could have lost the argument. And so when we get used to that idea of losing in disagreement, but coming back for another conversation, that I think again puts the focus on the importance of continuing the conversation and disagreeing in such a way that allows us to continue the conversation rather than it being on any particular win or loss.
Yeah. We've talked a great deal about the sort of polarized world in which we live. And I'm wondering, Beau, how optimistic you are that change will come, that those better angels that you referenced just a few minutes ago will ultimately take over, and that we could return to at least a time of greater civility, if not flat out unity, and how you think maybe debate can help us get there.
Tracy, the honest answer is my answer changes all the time. It changes all the time. And if there is a source of optimism for me, it is that the status quo, in which our arguments are painful, they're divisive, they make us feel stuck, they make us feel that we don't even have an inch in which to move, that actually works for very, very few people. Mm-hmm. That works for very few people. And I worry about, I say in the book, the people whose feelings are hurt or whose voices are silenced by, through the process of engaging in bad disagreements. Mm-hmm. But the people I really worry about are people who decide to rise above the fray and not to participate at all. Because I know what a life on that kind of margin looks like, right? And so for me, I find some hope in the fact that the way things are now doesn't work for many of us. I find hope that many people in day-to-day conversations are more reasonable, right, than our public figures, than our media avatars, than our social media presence might suggest. That it is true that people change their minds all the time. Mm-hmm. But it is ultimately for me an object of faith that the people who have been spun out of conversations, the people who have been deterred from participating at all, that we might be able to welcome them back into conversation.
Well, I think that is the perfect place to end our conversation for this evening. The book is called Good Arguments: How Debate Teaches Us to Listen and Be Heard. Bo, thank you so much for writing this book and for taking time to be with us this evening and helping us to understand how we can learn to disagree well and be better off for the disagreement than for having been silent or turned away from the conversation at all.
Thank you so much, Tracy. It was really a joy. And thank you and to the staff at the library for all that you do to enrich our public conversations. We're all indebted to you.
Well, and speaking of that, many thanks to Laura Kovacs for kicking us off this evening. And of course, to Andy and Jason, the members of the author events team at the Free Library of Philadelphia. I want to thank all of you for joining us tonight. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation. Please do stay safe, and we'll look forward to seeing you next time. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.